Being a pimp, I cannot deny it, but I never thought I was doing any harm by it, for the only object was that all the world should enjoy itself and live in peace and quiet without quarrels or troubles. But my good intentions were unavailing to save me from going where I never expect to come back from, with this weight of years upon me and a urinary ailment that never gives me a moment's ease. And again he fell to weeping as before, and such compassion did Sancho feel for him that he took out a real of 4 from his bosom and gave it to him in alms. Don Quixote went on and asked another what his crime was, and the man answered with no less but rather more sprightliness than the last one.
"I am here because I carried the joke too far with a couple of cousins of mine, and with a couple of other cousins who were none of mine. In short, I carried the joke so far with them all that it ended in such a complicated increase of kindred that no accountant could make it clear. It was all proved against me. I got no favour, I had no money, I was near having my neck stretched. They sentenced me to the galleys for 6 years. I accepted my fate. It is the punishment of my fault. I'm a young man, let life only last, and with that all will come right. If you, sir, have anything wherewith to help the poor, God will repay it to you in heaven, and we on earth will take care in our petitions to him to pray for the life and health of your worship, that they may be as long and as good as your amiable appearance deserves."
This one was in the dress of a student, and one of the guards said he was a great talker and a very elegant Latin scholar. Behind all these there came a man of 30, a very personable fellow, except that when he looked his eyes turned in a little one towards the other. He was bound differently from the rest, for he had to his leg a chain so long that it was wound all round his body, and 2 rings on his neck, one attached to the chain, the other to what they call a keep-friend or friend's foot, from which hung 2 irons reaching to his waist, with 2 manacles fixed to them, in which his hands were secured by a big padlock, so that he could neither raise his hands to his mouth nor lower his head to his hands. Don Quixote asked why this man carried so many more chains than the others. The guard replied that it was because he alone had committed more crimes than all the rest put together, and was so daring and such a villain that though they marched him in that fashion, they did not feel sure of him, but were in dread of his making his escape.
"What crimes can he have committed," said Don Quixote, "if they have not deserved a heavier punishment than being sent to the galleys?" "He goes for 10 years," replied the guard, "which is the same thing as civil death, and all that need be said is that this good fellow is the famous Gines de Pasamonte, otherwise called Ginesilio de Parapilia."
"Gently, Señor Commissary," said the galley-slave at this. "Let us have no fixing of names or surnames. My name is Gines, not Ginesilio, and my family name is Pasamonte, not Parapilia, as you say. Let each one mind his own business, and he will be doing enough."
"Speak with less impertinence, master thief of extra measure," replied the commissary, "if you don't want me to make you hold your tongue in spite of your teeth."
"It is easy to see," returned the galley-slave, "that a man goes as God pleases, but someone shall know some day whether I am called Ginesilio de Parapilia or not."
"Don't they call you so, you liar?" said the guard.
"They do," returned Gines, "but I will make them give over calling me so, or I will fleece them. Where, I only say behind my teeth. If you, sir, have anything to give us, give it to us at once, and God speed you, for you are becoming tiresome with all this inquisitiveness about the lives of others. If you want to know about mine, let me tell you I am Gines de Pasamonte, whose life is written by these fingers."
"He says true," said the commissary, "for he has himself written his story as grand as you please, and has left the book in a prison in pawn for 200 reals.
"And I mean to take it out of pawn," said Gines, "though it were in for 200 ducats.
"Is it so good?" said Don Quixote.
"So good is it," replied Gines, "that a fig for Lazarillo de Tormes and all of that kind that have been written or shall be written compared with it. All I will say about it is that it deals with facts, and facts so neat and diverting that no lies could match them."
"And how is the book entitled?" asked Don Quixote.
"The Life of Gines de Pasamonte," replied the subject of it.
"And is it finished?" asked Don Quixote.
"How can it be finished?" said the other, "when my life is not yet finished. All that is written is from my birth down to the point when they sent me to the galleys this last time."
"Then you have been there before," said Don Quixote.
"In the service of God and the King, I have been there for 4 years before now, and I know by this time what the biscuit and the lash are like," replied Gines. "And it is no great grievance to me to go back to them,
for there I shall have time to finish my book. I have still many things left to say, and in the galleys of Spain there is more than enough leisure, though I do not want much for what I have to write, for I have it by heart."
"You seem a clever fellow," said Don Quixote.
"And an unfortunate one," replied Gines, "for misfortune always persecutes good wit."
"It persecutes rogues," said the commissary.
"I told you already to go gently, Master Commissary," said Pasamonte.
"Their lordships yonder never gave you that staff to ill-treat us wretches here, but to conduct and take us where His Majesty orders you. If not, by the life of—"
"Never mind. It may be that some day the stains made in the inn will come out in the scouring. Let everyone hold his tongue and behave well and speak better. And now let us march on, for we have had quite enough of this entertainment."
The commissary lifted his staff to strike Pasamonte in return for his threats, but Don Quixote came between them, and begged him not to ill-use him, as it was not too much to allow one who had his hands tied to have his tongue a trifle free. And turning to the whole chain of them, he said,
"From all you have told me, dear brethren, make out clearly that though they have punished you for your faults, the punishments you are about to endure do not give you much pleasure, and that you go to them very much against the grain and against your will, and that perhaps this one's want of courage under torture, that one's want of money, the other's want of advocacy, and lastly the perverted judgment of the judge, may have been the cause of your ruin and of your failure to obtain the justice you had on your side. All which presents itself now to my mind, urging, persuading, and even compelling me to demonstrate in your case the purpose for which heaven sent me into the world, and caused me to take profession of the order of chivalry to which I belong, and the vow I took therein to give aid to those in need and under the oppression of the strong. But, as I know that it is a mark of prudence not to do by foul means what may be done by fair, I will ask these gentlemen, the guards and commissary, to be so good as to release you, and let you go in peace, as there will be no lack of others to serve the king under more favourable circumstances. For it seems to me a hard case to make slaves of those whom God and nature have made free. Moreover, sirs of the guard," added Don Quixote, "these poor fellows have done nothing to you. Let each answer for his own sins yonder. There is a God in heaven who will not forget to punish the wicked or reward the good. And it is not fitting that honest men should be the instruments of punishment to others, they being therein no way concerned. This request I make thus gently and quietly, that if you will comply with it I may have reason for thanking you. And if you will not voluntarily, this lance and sword together with the might of my arm shall compel you to comply with it by force."
"Nice nonsense," said the commissary. "A fine piece of pleasantry he has come out with at last. He wants us to let the king's prisoners go, as if we had any authority to release them, or he to order us to do so. Go your way, sir, and good luck to you. Put that basin straight that you've got on your head, and don't go looking for 3 feet on a cat."
"'Tis you that are a cat, rat, and a rascal," replied Don Quixote.
And acting on the word, he fell upon him so suddenly that without giving him time to defend himself, he brought him to the ground sorely wounded with a lance thrust. And lucky it was for him that it was the one that had the musket. The other guards stood thunderstruck and amazed at this unexpected event, but recovering presence of mind, those on horseback seized their swords and those on foot their javelins, and attacked Don Quixote, who was waiting for them with great calmness. And no doubt it would have gone badly with him, if the galley-slaves, seeing the chance before them of liberating themselves, had not so effected it by contriving to break the chain on which they were strung. Such was the confusion that the guards, now rushing at the galley-slaves who were breaking loose, now to attack Don Quixote who was waiting for them, did nothing at all that was of any use. Sancho, on his part, gave a helping hand to release Gines de Pasamonte, who was the first to leap forth upon the plain, free and unfettered, and who, attacking the prostrate commissary, took from him his sword and the musket, with which, aiming at one and levelling at another, he, without ever discharging it, drove every one of the guards off the field, for they took to flight, as well to escape Pasamonte's musket as the showers of stones the now released galley-slaves were raining upon them. Sancho was greatly grieved at the affair, because he anticipated that those who had fled would report the matter to the Holy Brotherhood, who, at the summons of the alarm bell, would at once sally forth in quest of the offenders. And he said so to his master, and entreated him to leave the place at once, and go into hiding in the sierra that was close by.
"That is all very well," said Don Quixote, "but I know what must be done now."
And calling together all the galley-slaves, who were now running riot, and had stripped the commissary to the skin, he collected them round him to hear what he had to say, and addressed them as follows.
"To be grateful for benefits received is the part of persons of good birth, and one of the sins most offensive to God is ingratitude. I say so because, sirs, ye have already seen by manifest proof the benefit ye have received of me, in return for which I desire, and it is my good pleasure, that, laden with that chain which I have taken off your necks, ye at once set out and proceed to the city of El Toboso, and there present yourselves before the lady Dulcinea del Toboso, and say to her that her knight, he of the rueful countenance, sends to commend himself to her, and that ye recount to her in full detail all the particulars of this notable adventure, up to the recovery of your longed-for liberty. And this done, ye may go where ye will, and good fortune attend you."
Gines de Pasamonte made answer for all, saying,
"That which you, sir, our deliverer, demand of us is, of all impossibilities, the most impossible to comply with, because we cannot go together along the roads, but only singly and separate, each one his own way, endeavouring to hide ourselves in the bowels of the earth to escape the Holy Brotherhood, which, no doubt, will come out in search of us. What your worship may do, and fairly do, is to change this service and tribute as regards the Lady Dulcinea del Toboso, for a certain quantity of Ave Marias and Credos, which we will say for your worship's intention, and this is a condition that can be complied with by night as by day, running or resting, in peace or in war. But to imagine that we are going now to return to the flesh-pots of Egypt, I mean to take up our chain and set out for El Toboso, is to imagine that it is now night, though it is not yet 10 in the morning. And to ask this of us is like asking pears of the elm tree."
"Then by all that's good," said Don Quixote, now stirred to wrath, "Don son of a bitch, Don Ginesilio de Paropilio, or whatever your name is, you will have to go yourself alone with your tail between your legs and the whole chain on your back."
Pasamonte, who was anything but meek, being by this time thoroughly convinced that Don Quixote was not quite right in his head, as he had committed such a vagary as to set them free, finding himself abused in this fashion, gave the wink to his companions, and falling back, they began to shower stones on Don Quixote at such a rate that he was quite unable to protect himself with his shield, and poor Rocinante no more heeded the spur than if he had been made of brass. Sancho planted himself behind his ass, and with him sheltered himself from the hailstorm that poured on both of them. Don Quixote was unable to shield himself so well, but that more pebbles than I could count struck him full on the body with such force that they brought him to the ground. And the instant he fell, the student pounced on him, snatched the basin from his head, and with it struck three or four blows on his shoulders and as many more on the ground, knocking it almost to pieces. They then stripped him of a jacket that he wore over his armour, and they would have stripped off his stockings if his greaves had not prevented them. From Sancho they took his coat, leaving him in his shirt-sleeves, and dividing among themselves the remaining spoils of the battle, they went each one his own way, more solicitous about keeping clear of the Holy Brotherhood they dreaded than about burdening themselves with the chain or going to present themselves before the Lady Dulcinea del Toboso. The ass and Rocinante, Sancho and Don Quixote, were all that were left upon the spot. The ass, with drooping head, serious, shaking his ears from time to time as if he thought the storm of stones that assailed them was not yet over. Rocinante stretched beside his master, for he, too, had been brought to the ground by a stone. Sancho stripped and trembling with fear of the Holy Brotherhood, and Don Quixote fuming to find himself so served by the very persons for whom he had done so much. Chapter 23 Of what befell Don Quixote in the Sierra Morena, which was one of the rarest adventures related in this veracious history. Seeing himself served in this way, Don Quixote said to his squire,
"I have always heard it said, Sancho, that to do good to boors is to throw water into the sea. If I had believed thy words, I should have avoided this trouble. But it is done now. It is only to have patience and take warning for the future."
"Your worship will take warning as much as I am a Turk," returned Sancho. "But, as you say, this mischief might have been avoided if you had believed me,
Believe me now, and a still greater one will be avoided. For I tell you, chivalry is of no account with the Holy Brotherhood, and they don't care tuppence for all the knights-errant in the world. And I can tell you, I fancy I hear their arrows whistling past my ears this minute.
Thou art a coward by nature, Sancho, said Don Quixote. But lest thou should say I am obstinate, and that I never do as thou dost advise, this once I will take thy advice, and withdraw out of reach of that fury thou so dreadest. But it must be on one condition, that never, in life or in death, thou art to say to any one that I retired or withdrew from this danger out of fear, but only in compliance with thy entreaties. For if thou sayest otherwise, thou wilt lie therein, and from this time to that, and from that time to this, I give thee lie, and say thou liest, and wilt lie every time thou thinkest or sayest it, and answer me not again. For at the mere thought that I am withdrawing or retiring from any danger above all from this, which does seem to carry some little shadow of fear with it, I am ready to take my stand here and await alone, not only that holy brotherhood you talk of and dread, but the brothers of the 12 tribes of Israel, and the 7 Maccabees, and Castor and Pollux, and all the brothers and brotherhoods in the world.
Señor, replied Sancho, to retire is not to flee, and there is no wisdom in waiting when danger outweighs hope, and it is the part of wise men to preserve themselves today for tomorrow, and not risk all in one day. And let me tell you, though I am a clown and a boor, I have got some notion of what they call safe conduct. So repent not of having taken my advice, but mount Rocinante, if you can, and if not, I will help you, and follow me, for my mother-wit tells me we have more need of legs than hands just now.
Don Quixote mounted without replying, and Sancho, leading the way on his ass, they entered the side of the Sierra Morena, which was close by, as it was Sancho's design to cross it entirely and come out again at El Viso or Almodóvar del Campo, and hide for some days among its crags, so as to escape the search of the Brotherhood, should they come to look for them. He was encouraged in this by perceiving that the stock of provisions carried by the ass had come safe out of the fray with the galley-slaves, a circumstance that he regarded as a miracle, seeing how they pillaged and ransacked. That night they reached the very heart of the Sierra Morena, where it seemed prudent to Sancho to pass the night, and even some days, at least as many as the stores he carried might last, and so they encamped between two rocks and among some cork trees. But fatal destiny, which, according to the opinion of those who have not the light of the true faith, directs, arranges, and settles everything in its own way, so ordered it that Gines de Pasamonte, the famous knave and thief who by the virtue and madness of Don Quixote had been released from the chain, driven by fear of the Holy Brotherhood, which he had good reason to dread, resolved to take hiding in the mountains. And his fate and fear led him to the same spot to which Don Quixote and Sancho Panza had been led by theirs, just in time to recognize them and leave them to fall asleep. And as the wicked are always ungrateful, and necessity leads to evil-doing, and immediate advantage overcomes all considerations of the future, Gines, who was neither grateful nor well-principled, made up his mind to steal Sancho Panza's ass, not troubling himself about Rocinante, as being a prize that was no good either to pledge or sell. While Sancho slept, he stole his ass, and before day dawned he was far out of reach. Aurora made her appearance, bringing gladness to the earth, but sadness to Sancho Panza, for he found that his Dapple was missing, and seeing himself bereft of him, he began the saddest and most doleful lament in the world, so loud that Don Quixote awoke at his exclamations and heard him saying, "Oh, son of my bowels, born in my very house, my children's plaything, my wife's joy, the envy of my neighbors, relief of my burdens, and, lastly, half-supporter of myself, for with the 6 pence halfpenny thou dost earn me daily, I meet half my charges." Don Quixote, when he heard the lament and learned the cause, consoled Sancho with the best arguments he could, entreating him to be patient and promising to give him a letter of exchange, ordering 3 out of 5 ass-colts that he had at home to be given to him. Sancho took comfort at this, dried his tears, suppressed his sobs, and returned thanks for the kindness shown him by Don Quixote. He, on his part, was rejoiced to the heart on entering the mountains, as they seemed to him to be just the place for the adventures he was in quest of. They brought back to his memory the marvellous adventures that had befallen knights errant in like solitudes and wilds, and he went along reflecting on these things, so absorbed and carried away by them that he had no thought for anything else. Nor had Sancho any other care, now that he fancied he was travelling in a safe quarter, than to satisfy his appetite with such remains as were left of the clerical spoils. And so he marched behind his master laden with what Dapple used to carry, emptying the sack and packing his paunch, and so long as he could go that way, he would not have given a farthing to meet with another adventure. While so engaged, he raised his eyes and saw that his master had halted, and was trying with the point of his pike to lift some bulky object that lay upon the ground, on which he hastened to join him and help him, if it were needful, and reached him just as, with the point of the pike, he was raising a saddle-pad with a valise attached to it, half, or rather wholly, rotten and torn. But so heavy were they that Sancho had to help to take them up, and his master directed him to see what the valise contained. Sancho did so with great alacrity, and though the valise was secured by a chain and padlock, from its torn and rotten condition he was able to see its contents, which were 4 shirts of fine holland, and other articles of linen no less curious than clean, and in a handkerchief he found a good lot of gold crowns. And as soon as he saw them he exclaimed, "Blessed be all heaven for sending us an adventure that is good for something!" Searching further, he found a little memorandum-book richly bound. This Don Quixote asked of him, telling him to take the money and keep it for himself. Sancho kissed his hands for the favour, and cleared the valise of its linen, which he stowed away in the provision sack. Considering the whole matter, Don Quixote observed, "It seems to me, Sancho, and it is impossible it can be otherwise, that some strayed traveller must have crossed this sierra and been attacked and slain by footpads, who brought him to this remote spot to bury him." "That cannot be," answered Sancho, "because if they had been robbers, they would not have left the money." "Thou art right," said Don Quixote, "and I cannot guess or explain what this may mean. But stay, let us see if in this memorandum book there is anything written by which we may be able to trace out or discover what we want to know." He opened it, and the first thing he found in it, written roughly but in a very good hand, was a sonnet, and reading it aloud that Sancho might hear it, he found that it ran as follows. Sonnet. Or love is lacking in intelligence, or to the height of cruelty attains, or else it is my doom to suffer pains beyond the measure due to my offence. But if love be a god, it follows thence that he knows all, and certain it remains no god loves cruelty. Then who ordains this penance that enthralls while it torments? It were a falsehood, Chloe, thee to name. Such evil with such goodness cannot live, and against heaven I dare not charge the blame. I only know it is my fate to die. To him who knows not whence his malady a miracle alone a cure can give.
There is nothing to be learned from that rhyme, said Sancho, unless by that clue there's in it one may draw out the ball of the whole matter.
What clue is there? Said Don Quixote.
I thought your worship spoke of a clue in it, said Sancho.
I only said Chloe, replied Don Quixote, and that no doubt is the name of the lady of whom the author of the sonnet complains, and, faith, he must be a tolerable poet, or I know little of the craft.
Then your worship understands rhyming, too?
And better than thou thinkest, replied Don Quixote, as thou shalt see when thou carriest a letter written in verse from beginning to end, to my lady Dulcinea del Toboso, for I would have thee know, Sancho, that all or most of the knights errant in days of yore were great troubadours and great musicians. For both of these accomplishments, or more properly speaking, gifts, are the peculiar property of lovers errant. True it is that the verses of the knights of old have more spirit than neatness in them.
Read more, your worship, said Sancho, and you will find something that will enlighten us.
Don Quixote turned the page and said, "This is prose, and seems to be a letter."
"A correspondence letter, senor?"
"From the beginning it seems to be a love letter," replied Don Quixote.
"Then let your worship read it aloud," said Sancho, "for I'm very fond of love matters."
"With all my heart," said Don Quixote. And reading it aloud as Sancho had requested him, he found it ran thus. Your false promise and my sure misfortune carry me to a place whence the news of my death will reach your ears before the words of my complaint. Ungrateful one, you have rejected me for one more wealthy, but not more worthy. But if virtue were esteemed wealth, I should neither envy the fortunes of others nor weep for misfortunes of my own. What your beauty raised up, your deeds have laid low. By it I believed you to be an angel, by them I know you are a woman. Peace be with you, who has sent war to me, and heaven grant that the deceit of your husband be ever hidden from you, so that you repent not of what you have done, and I reap not a revenge I would not have. When he had finished the letter, Don Quixote said,
There is less to be gathered from this than from the verses, except that he who wrote it is some rejected lover.
And turning over nearly all the pages of the book, he found more verses and letters, some of which he could read, while others he could not. But they were all made up of complaints, laments, misgivings, desires and aversions, favours and rejections, some rapturous, some doleful. While Don Quixote examined the book, Sancho examined the valise, not leaving a corner in the whole of it, or in the pad, that he did not search, peer into, and explore, or seam, that he did not rip, or tuft of wool, that he did not pick to pieces, lest anything should escape for want of care and pains. So keen was the covetousness excited in him by the discovery of the crowns, which amounted to near 100, and though he found no more booty, he held the blanket flights, balsam vomits, stake benedictions, carrier's fisticuffs, missing saddlebags, stolen coat, and all the hunger, thirst, and weariness he had endured in the service of his good master, cheap at the price, as he considered himself more than fully indemnified for all by the payment he received in the gift of the treasure trove. The knight of the rueful countenance was still very anxious to find out who the owner of the valise could be, conjecturing from the sonnet and letter, from the money in gold, and from the fineness of the shirts, that he must be some lover of distinction, whom the scorn and cruelty of his lady had driven to some desperate course. But as in that uninhabited and rugged spot there was no one to be seen of whom he could inquire, he saw nothing else for it but to push on, taking whatever road Rocinante chose, which was where he could make his way, firmly persuaded that among these wilds he could not fail to meet some rare adventure. As he went along, then, occupied with these thoughts, he perceived on the summit of a height that rose before their eyes a man who went springing from rock to rock and from tussock to tussock with marvellous agility. As well as he could make out, he was unclad, with a thick black beard, long, tangled hair, and bare legs and feet. His thighs were covered by breeches, apparently of tawny velvet, but so ragged that they showed his skin in several places. He was bareheaded, and notwithstanding the swiftness with which he passed, as has been described, the knight of the rueful countenance observed and noted all these trifles, and though he made the attempt, he was unable to follow him, for it was not granted to the feebleness of Rocinante to make way over such rough ground, he being, moreover, slow-paced and sluggish by nature. Don Quixote at once came to the conclusion that this was the owner of the saddle-pad and of the valise, and made up his mind to go in search of him, even though he should have to wander a year in those mountains before he found him. And so he directed Sancho to take a short cut over one side of the mountain, while he himself went by the other, and perhaps by this means they might light upon this man who had passed so quickly out of their sight.
"I could not do that," said Sancho, "for when I separate from your worship, fear at once lays hold of me and assails me with all sorts of panics and fancies. And let what I now say be a notice that from this time forth I am not going to stir a finger's width from your presence."
"It shall be so," said he of the rueful countenance. "And I am very glad that thou art willing to rely on my courage, which will never fail thee, even though the soul in thy body fail thee. So come on now behind me, slowly as well as thou canst, and make lanterns of thine eyes. Let us make the circuit of this ridge. Perhaps we shall light upon this man that we saw, who no doubt is no other than the owner of what we found."
To which Sancho made answer, "Far better would it be not to look for him, for if we find him, and he happens to be the owner of the money, it's plain I must restore it.
and it would be better, therefore, that without taking this needless trouble I should keep possession of it until in some other less meddlesome and officious way the real owner may be discovered. And perhaps that will be when I shall have spent it, and then the king will hold me harmless.
"Thou art wrong there, Sancho," said Don Quixote, "for now that we have a suspicion who the owner is, and have him almost before us, we are bound to seek him and make restitution. And if we do not see him, the strong suspicion we have as to his being the owner makes us as guilty as if he were so. And so, friend Sancho, let not our search for him give thee any uneasiness, for if we find him, it will relieve mine." And so saying, he gave Rocinante the spur, and Sancho followed him on foot and loaded, and after having partly made the circuit of the mountain, they found lying in a ravine, dead and half-devoured by dogs and pecked by jackdaws, a mule, saddled and bridled, all which still further strengthened their suspicion that he who had fled was the owner of the mule and the saddle-pad. As they stood looking at it, they heard a whistle like that of a shepherd watching his flock, and suddenly on their left there appeared a great number of goats, and behind them, on the summit of the mountain, the goat-herd in charge of them, a man advanced in years. Don Quixote called aloud to him and begged him to come to where they stood. He shouted in return, asking what had brought them to that spot, seldom or never trodden except by the feet of goats, or of the wolves or other wild beasts that roamed around. Sancho, in return, bade him come down, and they would explain all to him. The goat-herd descended, and reaching the place where Don Quixote stood, he said,
"I wager you're looking at that hack mule that lies dead in the hollow there. And faith, it has been lying there now these 6 months. Tell me, have you come upon its master about here?"
"We have come upon nobody," answered Don Quixote,
"nor on anything except a saddle-pad and a little valise that we found not far from this."
"I found it too," said the goat-herd, "but I would not lift it nor go near it for fear of some ill luck or being charged with theft, for the devil is crafty, and things rise up under one's feet to make one fall without knowing why or wherefore."
"That's exactly what I say," said Sancho. "I found it too, and I would not go within a stone's throw of it. There I left it, and there it lies, just as it was, for I don't want a dog with a bell."
"Tell me, good man," said Don Quixote, "do you know who is the owner of this property?"
"All I can tell you," said the goatherd, "is that about 6 months ago, more or less, there arrived at a shepherd's hut 3 leagues, perhaps, away from this, a youth of well-bred appearance and manners, mounted on that same mule which lies dead here, and with the same saddle-pad and valise which, you say, you found and did not touch. He asked us what part of the Sierra was the most rugged and retired. We told him that it was where we are now, and so in truth it is, for if you push on half a league farther, perhaps you'll not be able to find your way out. And I'm wondering how you've managed to come here, for there is no road or path that leads to this spot. I say, then, that on hearing our answer, the youth turned about and made for the place we pointed out to him, leaving us all charmed with his good looks, and wondering at his question and the haste with which we saw him depart in the direction of the Sierra. And after that we saw him no more, until some days afterwards he crossed the path of one of our shepherds, and without saying a word to him, came up to him and gave him several cuffs and kicks, and then turned to the ass with our provisions, and took all the bread and cheese it carried, and having done this, made off back again into the Sierra with extraordinary swiftness. When some of us goat-herds learned this, we went in search of him for about 2 days, through the most remote portion of this Sierra, at the end of which we found him lodged in the hollow of a large, thick cork tree. He came out to meet us with great gentleness, with his dress now torn and his face so disfigured and burned by the sun that we already recognized him, but that his clothes, though torn, convinced us, from the recollection we had of them, that he was the person we were looking for. He saluted us courteously, and in a few well-spoken words he told us not to wonder at seeing him going about in this guise, as it was binding upon him in order that he might work out a penance which for his many sins had been imposed on him. We asked him to tell us who he was, but we were never able to find out from him. We begged of him, too, when he was in want of food, which he could not do without, to tell us where we should find him, as we would bring it to him with all good will and readiness, or, if this were not to his taste, at least to come and ask it of us and not take it by force from the shepherds. He thanked us for the offer, begged pardon for the late assault, and promised for the future to ask it in God's name without offering violence to anybody. As for fixed abode, he said he had none other than that which chance offered wherever night might overtake him. And his words
ended in an outburst of weeping so bitter that we who listened to him must have been very stoned had we not joined him in it, comparing what we saw of him the first time with what we saw now. For, as I said, he was a graceful and gracious youth, and in his courteous and polished language showed himself to be of good birth and courtly breeding, and rustics as we were that listened to him, even to our rusticity, his gentle bearing sufficed to make it plain. But in the midst of his conversation he stopped, and became silent, keeping his eyes fixed upon the ground for some time, during which we stood still, waiting anxiously to see what would come of this abstraction, and with no little pity, for from his behaviour, now staring at the ground with fixed gaze and eyes wide open without moving an eyelid, again closing them, compressing his lips and raising his eyebrows, we could perceive plainly that a fit of madness of some kind had come upon him, and before long he showed that what we imagined was the truth, for he arose in a fury from the ground where he had thrown himself, and attacked the first he found near him with such rage and fierceness that if we had not dragged him off he would have beaten or bitten him to death, all the while exclaiming, "O faithless Fernando, here, here shalt thou pay the penalty of the wrong thou hast done me. These hands shall tear out that heart of thine, abode and dwelling of all iniquity, but of deceit and fraud above all." And to these he added other words, all in effect upbraiding this Fernando and charging him with treachery and faithlessness. We forced him to release his hold with no little difficulty, and without another word he left us, and, rushing off, plunged in among these brakes and brambles so as to make it impossible for us to follow him. From this we suppose that madness comes upon him from time to time, and that someone called Fernando must have done him a wrong of a grievous nature, such as the condition to which it had brought him seemed to show. All this has been since then confirmed on those occasions, and they have been many, on which he has crossed our path. At one time to beg the shepherds to give him some of the food they carry, at another to take it from them by force. For when there is a fit of madness upon him, even though the shepherds offer it freely, he will not accept it, but snatches it from them by dint of blows. But when he is in his senses, he begs it for the love of God, courteously and civilly, and receives it with many thanks and not a few tears. And to tell you the truth, sirs, continued the goatherd, it was yesterday that we resolved, I and four of the lads, two of them our servants and the other two friends of mine, to go in search of him until we find him, and when we do, to take him, whether by force or of his own consent, to the town of Almodovar, which is 8 leagues from this, and there strive to cure him, if indeed his malady admits of a cure, or learn, when he is in his senses, who he is, and if he has relatives to whom we may give notice of his misfortune. This, sirs, is all I can say in answer to what you have asked me. And be sure that the owner of the articles you found is he whom you saw pass by with such nimbleness and so naked. For Don Quixote had already described how he had seen the man go bounding along the mountainside, and he was now filled with amazement at what he heard from the goatherd, and more eager than ever to discover who the unhappy madman was. And in his heart he resolved, as he had done before, to search for him all over the mountain, not leaving a corner or cave unexamined until he had found him. But chance arranged matters better than he expected or hoped, for at that very moment in a gorge on the mountain that opened where they stood, the youth he wished to find made his appearance, coming along talking to himself in a way that would have been unintelligible near at hand, much more at a distance. His garb was what has been described, save that, as he drew near, Don Quixote perceived that a tattered doublet which he wore was amber-tanned, from which he concluded that one who wore such garments could not be of very low rank. Approaching them, the youth greeted them in a harsh and hoarse voice, but with great courtesy. Don Quixote returned his salutation with equal politeness, and, dismounting from Rocinante, advanced with well-bred bearing and grace to embrace him, and held him for some time close in his arms as if he had known him for a long time. The other, whom we may call the ragged one of the sorry countenance, as Don Quixote was of the rueful, after submitting to the embrace, pushed him back a little, and, placing his hands on Don Quixote's shoulders, stood gazing at him, as if seeking to see whether he knew him, not less amazed, perhaps, at the sight of the face, figure, and armour of Don Quixote, than Don Quixote was at the sight of him. To be brief, the first to speak after embracing was the ragged one, and he said, "What will be told farther on?" Chapter 24.
in which is continued the adventure of the Sierra Morena. The history relates that it was with the greatest attention Don Quixote listened to the ragged knight of the Sierra, who began by saying,
"Of a surety, señor, whoever you are, for I know you not, I thank you for the proofs of kindness and courtesy you have shown me, and would I were in a condition to requite with something more than goodwill that which you have displayed towards me in the cordial reception you have given me. But my fate does not afford me any other means of returning kindnesses done me, save the hearty desire to repay them."
"Mine," replied Don Quixote, "is to be of service to you, so much so that I had resolved not to quit these mountains until I had found you, and learned of you whether there is any kind of relief to be found for that sorrow under which, from the strangeness of your life, you seem to labour, and to search for you with all possible diligence, if search had been necessary. And if your misfortune should prove to be one of those that refuse admission to any sort of consolation, it was my purpose to join you in lamenting and mourning over it, so far as I could. For it is still some comfort in misfortune to find one who can feel for it. And if my good intentions deserve to be acknowledged with any kind of courtesy, I entreat you, señor, by that which I perceive you possess in so high a degree, and likewise conjure you by whatever you love or have loved best in life, to tell me who you are, and the cause that has brought you to live or die in these solitudes like a brute beast, dwelling among them in a manner so foreign to your condition as your garb and appearance show. And I swear," added Don Quixote, "by the order of knighthood which I have received, and by my vocation of knight-errant, if you gratify me in this, to serve you with all the zeal my calling demands of me, either in relieving your misfortune if it admits of relief, or in joining you in lamenting it, as I promise to do."
The knight of the thicket, hearing him of the rueful countenance talk in this strain, did nothing but stare at him, and stare at him again, and again survey him from head to foot, and when he had thoroughly examined him, he said to him,
"If you have anything to give me to eat, for God's sake give it me, and after I have eaten I will do all you ask in acknowledgment of the goodwill you have displayed towards me."
Sancho from his sack, and the goat-herd from his pouch, furnished the ragged one with the means of appeasing his hunger, and what they gave him he ate like a half-witted thing, so hastily that he took no time between mouthfuls, gorging rather than swallowing. And while he ate, neither he nor they who observed him uttered a word. As soon as he had done, he made signs to them to follow him, which they did, and he led them to a green plot which lay a little farther off round the corner of a rock. On reaching it, he stretched himself upon the grass, and the others did the same, all keeping silence, until the ragged one, settling himself in his place, said,
"If it is your wish, sirs, that I should disclose in a few words the surpassing extent of my misfortunes, you must promise not to break the thread of my sad story with any question or other interruption, for the instant you do so the tale I tell will come to an end."
These words of the ragged one reminded Don Quixote of the tale his squire had told him, when he failed to keep count of the goats that had crossed the river, and the story remained unfinished. But to return to the ragged one, he went on to say,
"I give you this warning because I wish to pass briefly over the story of my misfortunes, for recalling them to memory only serves to add fresh ones, and the less you question me the sooner shall I make an end of the recital, though I shall not omit to relate anything of importance, in order fully to satisfy your curiosity."
Don Quixote gave the promise for himself and the others, and with this assurance he began as follows.
"My name is Cardenio, my birthplace one of the best cities of this Andalusia, my family noble, my parents rich, my misfortune so great that my parents must have wept and my family grieved over it without being able by their wealth to lighten it. For the gifts of fortune can do little to relieve reverses sent by heaven. In that same country there was a heaven in which love had placed all the glory I could desire. Such was the beauty of Lucinda, a damsel as noble and as rich as I, but of happier fortunes, and of less firmness than was due to so worthy a passion as mine. This Lucinda I loved, worshipped, and adored from my earliest and tenderest years, and she loved me in all the innocence and sincerity of childhood. Our parents were aware of our feelings, and were
not sorry to perceive them, for they saw clearly that, as they ripened, they must lead at last to a marriage between us, a thing that seemed almost prearranged by the equality of our families and wealth. We grew up, and with our growth grew the love between us, so that the father of Lucinda felt bound, for propriety's sake, to refuse me admission to his house, in this perhaps imitating the parents of that Thisbe so celebrated by the poets, and this refusal but added love to love, and flame to flame. For though they enforced silence upon our tongues, they could not impose it upon our pens, which can make known the heart's secrets to a loved one more freely than tongues. For many a time the presence of the object of love shakes the firmest will, and strikes dumb the boldest tongue. Ah, heavens! How many letters did I write her, and how many dainty, modest replies did I receive? How many ditties and love-songs did I compose in which my heart declared and made known its feelings, described its ardent longings, revelled in its recollections, and dallied with its desires? At length, growing impatient and feeling my heart languishing with longing to see her, I resolved to put into execution and carry out what seemed to me the best mode of winning my desired and merited reward, to ask her of her father for my lawful wife, which I did. To this his answer was that he thanked me for the disposition I showed to do honour to him and to regard myself as honoured by the bestowal of his treasure, but that, as my father was alive, it was his by right to make this demand, for if it were not in accordance with his full will and pleasure, Lucinda was not to be taken or given by stealth. I thanked him for his kindness, reflecting that there was reason in what he said, and that my father would assent to it as soon as I should tell him, and with that view I went the very same instant to let him know what my desires were. When I entered the room where he was, I found him with an open letter in his hand, which, before I could utter a word, he gave me, saying, "By this letter thou wilt see, Cardenio, the disposition the Duke Ricardo has to serve thee. This Duke Ricardo, as you, sirs, probably know already, is a grandee of Spain who has his seat in the best part of this Andalusia. I took and read the letter, which was couched in terms so flattering that even I myself felt it would be wrong in my father not to comply with the request the Duke made in it, which was that he would send me immediately to him, as he wished me to become the companion, not servant, of his eldest son, and would take upon himself the charge of placing me in a position corresponding to the esteem in which he held me. On reading the letter, my voice failed me, and still more when I heard my father say, 2 days hence wilt thou depart, Cardenio, in accordance with the Duke's wish, and give thanks to God who is opening a road to thee by which thou mayest attain what I know thou dost deserve.' And to these words he added others of fatherly counsel. The time for my departure arrived. I spoke one night to Lucinda. I told her all that had occurred, as I did also to her father, entreating him to allow some delay and to defer the disposal of her hand until I should see what the Duke Ricardo sought of me. He gave me the promise, and she confirmed it with vows and swoonings unnumbered. Finally, I presented myself to the Duke, and was received and treated by him so kindly that very soon envy began to do its work, the old servants growing envious of me and regarding the Duke's inclination to show me favour as an injury to themselves. But the one to whom my arrival gave the greatest pleasure was the Duke's second son, Fernando by name, a gallant youth of noble, generous, and amorous disposition, who very soon made so intimate a friend of me that it was remarked by everybody. For though the elder was attached to me and showed me kindness, he did not carry his affectionate treatment to the same length as Don Fernando. It so happened, then, that as between friends no secret remains unshared, and as the favour I enjoyed with Don Fernando had grown into friendship, he made all his thoughts known to me, and in particular a love affair which troubled his mind a little. He was deeply in love with a peasant girl, a vassal of his father's, the daughter of wealthy parents, and herself so beautiful, modest, discreet, and virtuous, that no one who knew her was able to decide in which of these respects she was most highly gifted or most excelled. The attractions of the fair peasant raised the passion of Don Fernando to such a point that in order to gain his object and overcome her virtuous resolutions, he determined to pledge his word to her to become her husband, for to attempt it in any other way was to attempt an impossibility. Bound to him as I was by friendship, I strove by the best arguments and the most forcible examples I could think of to restrain and dissuade him from such a course. But perceiving I produced no effect, I resolved to make the Duke Ricardo, his father, acquainted with the matter. But Don Fernando, being sharp-witted and shrewd, foresaw and apprehended this. Perceiving that by my duty as a good servant I was bound not to keep concealed a thing so much opposed to the honour of my lord the Duke. And so, to mislead and deceive me, he told me he could find no better way of effacing from his mind the beauty that so enslaved him than by absenting himself for some months, and that he wished the absence to be effected by our going, both of us, to my father's house, under the pretence which he would make to the Duke of going to see and buy some fine horses that were in my city, which produces the best in the world. When I heard him say so, even if his resolution had not been so good a one, I should have hailed it as one of the happiest that could be imagined, prompted by my affection, seeing what a favourable chance and opportunity it offered me of returning to see my Lucinda. With this thought and wish, I commended his idea and encouraged his design, advising him to put it into execution as quickly as possible, as, in truth, absence produced its effect in spite of the most deeply rooted feelings. But as afterwards appeared, when he said this to me, he had already enjoyed the peasant girl under the title of husband, and was waiting for an opportunity of making it known with safety to himself, being in dread of what his father the Duke would do when he came to know of his folly. It happened, then, that, as with young men, love is for the most part nothing more than appetite, which, as its final object is enjoyment, comes to an end on obtaining it, and that which seems to be love takes to flight, as it cannot pass the limit fixed by nature, which fixes no limit to true love. What I mean is that after Don Fernando had enjoyed this peasant girl, his passion subsided and his eagerness cooled, and if at first he feigned a wish to absent himself in order to cure his love, he was now in reality anxious to go, to avoid keeping his promise. The Duke gave him permission and ordered me to accompany him. We arrived at my city, and my father gave him the reception due to his rank. I saw Lucinda without delay, and though it had not been dead or deadened, my love gathered fresh life. To my sorrow, I told the story of it to Don Fernando, for I thought that in virtue of the great friendship he bore me, I was bound to conceal nothing from him. I extolled her beauty, her gaiety, her wit, so warmly that my praises excited in him a desire to see a damsel adorned by such attractions. To my misfortune, I yielded to it. Showing her to him one night by the light of a taper at a window where we used to talk to one another. As she appeared to him in her dressing-gown, she drove all the beauties he had seen until then out of his recollection. Speech failed him, his head turned, he was spellbound, and in the end love-smitten, as you will see in the course of the story of my misfortune. And to inflame still further his passion, which he hid from me and revealed to heaven alone, it so happened that one day he found a note of hers entreating me to demand her of her father in marriage, so delicate, so modest, and so tender, that on reading it he told me that in Lucinda alone were combined all the charms of beauty and understanding that were distributed among all the other women in the world. It is true, and I own it now, that though I knew what good cause Don Fernando had to praise Lucinda, it gave me uneasiness to hear these praises from his mouth. And I began to fear, and with reason to feel distrust of him, for there was no moment when he was not ready to talk of Lucinda, and he would start the subject himself, even though he dragged it in unseasonably, a circumstance that aroused in me a certain amount of jealousy. Not that I feared any change in the constancy or faith of Lucinda, but still my fate led me to forebode what she assured me against. Don Fernando contrived always to read the letters I sent to Lucinda, and her answers to me, under the pretense that he enjoyed the wit and sense of both. It so happened, then, that Lucinda, having begged of me a book of chivalry to read, one that she was very fond of, Amadis of Gaul, Don Quixote had no sooner heard a book of chivalry mentioned than he said, "Had your worship told me at the beginning of your story that the Lady Lucinda was fond of books of chivalry, no other laudation would have been requisite to impress upon me the superiority of her understanding.
for it could not have been of the excellence you describe, had a taste for such delightful reading been wanting. So, as far as I am concerned, you need waste no more words in describing her beauty, worth, and intelligence, for on merely hearing what her taste was, I declare her to be the most beautiful and the most intelligent woman in the world.
And I wish your worship had, along with Amadis of Gaul, sent her the worthy Don Ruchel of Greece, for I know the Lady Lucinda would greatly relish Daraida and Garaya, and the shrewd sayings of the shepherd Dardanel, and the admirable verses of his bucolics, sung and delivered by him with such sprightliness, wit, and ease.
But a time may come when this omission can be remedied, and to rectify it nothing more is needed than for your worship to be so good as to come with me to my village, for there I can give you more than 300 books which are the delight of my soul and the entertainment of my life. Though it occurs to me that I have not got one of them now, thanks to the spite of wicked and envious enchanters. But pardon me for having broken the promise we made not to interrupt your discourse, for when I hear chivalry or knights errant mentioned, I can no more help talking about them than the rays of the sun can help giving heat, or those of the moon moisture. Pardon me, therefore, and proceed, for that is more to the purpose now.
While Don Quixote was saying this, Cardenio allowed his head to fall upon his breast, and seemed plunged in deep thought. And though twice Don Quixote bade him to go on with his story, he neither looked up nor uttered a word in reply. But after some time he raised his head and said,
"I cannot get rid of the idea, nor will anyone in the world remove it, or make me think otherwise, and he would be a blockhead who would hold or believe anything else than that that arrant knave Master Elizabad made free with Queen Marasima."
"That is not true, by all that's good,"
said Don Quixote in high wrath, turning upon him angrily as his way was,
"and it is a very great slander, or rather villainy. Queen Madasima was a very illustrious lady, and it is not to be supposed that so exalted a princess would have made free with a quack, and whoever maintains the contrary lies like a great scoundrel, and I will give him to know it on foot or on horseback, armed or unarmed, by night or by day, or as he likes best."
Cardenio was looking at him steadily, and his mad fit having now come upon him, he had no disposition to go on with his story, nor would Don Quixote have listened to it, so much had what he had heard about Madasima disgusted him. Strange to say, he stood up for her as if she were in earnest his veritable born lady. To such a pass had his unholy books brought him. Cardenio, then, being, as I said, now mad, when he heard himself given the lie and called a scoundrel and other insulting names, not relishing the jest, snatched up a stone that he found near him, and with it delivered such a blow on Don Quixote's breast that he laid him on his back. Sancho Panza, seeing his master treated in this fashion, attacked the madman with his closed fist, but the ragged one received him in such a way that with a blow of his fist he stretched him at his feet, and then, mounting upon him, crushed his ribs to his own satisfaction. The goatherd, who came to the rescue, shared the same fate, and having beaten and pummeled them all, he left them, and quietly withdrew to his hiding-place on the mountain. Sancho rose, and with the rage he felt at finding himself so belaboured without deserving it, ran to take vengeance on the goatherd, accusing him of not giving them warning that this man was at times taken with a mad fit, for if they had known it, they would have been on their guard to protect themselves. The goatherd replied that he had said so, and that if he had not heard him, that was no fault of his. Sancho retorted, and the goatherd rejoined, and the altercation ended in their seizing each other by the beard, and exchanging such fisticuffs that if Don Quixote had not made peace between them, they would have knocked one another to pieces.
"Leave me alone, Sir Knight of the Rueful Countenance," said Sancho, grappling with the goatherd, "for of this fellow who is a clown like myself, and no dubbed knight, I can safely take satisfaction for the affront he has offered me, fighting with him hand to hand like an honest man."
"That is true," said Don Quixote, "but I know that he is not to blame for what has happened."
With this he pacified them, and again asked the goatherd if it would be possible to find Cardenio, as he felt the greatest anxiety to know the end of his story. The goatherd told him, as he had told him before, that there was no knowing of a certainty where his lair was, but that if he wandered about much in that neighbourhood he could not fail to fall in with him, either in or out of his senses. Chapter 25, which treats of the strange things that happened to the stout knight of La Mancha in the Sierra Morena, and of his imitation of the penance of Beltenebros. Don Quixote took leave of the goatherd, and once more mounting Rocinante bade Sancho follow him, which he, having no ass, did very discontentedly. They proceeded slowly, making their way into the most rugged part of the mountain, Sancho all the while dying to have a talk with his master, and longing for him to begin so that there should be no breach of the injunction laid upon him. But unable to keep silence so long, he said to him,
"Señor Don Quixote, give me your worship's blessing and dismissal, for I'd like to go home at once to my wife and children, with whom I can at any rate talk and converse as much as I like. For to want me to go through these solitudes